Saturday, I will be heading out to HBC, where I'll be serving again as program assistant with Josh Burkholder and the other camp staff. Really looking forward to that. Pray for us this summer. There's a lot of kids going to come through, especially for the community initiative weeks. And we'd really appreciate your prayers. But tonight we are going to look at Isaiah. We're moving on to a new genre now as we move through the books of the Old Testament. First, we started with the books of history and the law of Moses, really far back history. Then we moved to the books of poetry, and now we're moving into a category, the prophets. And Isaiah is the first in this new genre of the prophets. He is what they call a major prophet because of the amount of material in his book, and really it is quite significant, 66 chapters. The title Isaiah comes from the name of the author. The Hebrew name Isaiah means the Lord is salvation. The Lord is salvation. And the meaning of Isaiah is similar to the meanings of Joshua, Elisha, and Jesus. The book of Isaiah is quoted 65 or more times in the New Testament, making it the most quoted prophetic book in the Old Testament that shows up in the New Testament. So it's more often quoted than any other writing prophet. So that'd be Isaiah and the prophets that come after him in the Old Testament. A subtitle that I think if you read through the book, you will arrive at just in a really short statement is the coming Messiah. And as we read through the book, we find time after time when the Messiah is foretold in one manner or another. Sometimes they're kind of squished together. And we're going to discuss that a little bit more later on tonight, a term called prophetic foreshortening. But the coming Messiah really is a key feature of this book. And the summary then would be that the prophet Isaiah, while acting as God's mouthpiece to Judah's kings, provides a highly detailed foretelling of the Messiah. And some of the most detailed accounts of the Messiah come from this book. The author Isaiah, a little bit of a character sketch here. He is the son of Amoz, and he ministered in the area of Jerusalem during the reign of four of Judah's kings from the years 739 to 686 BC. And because we find him having easy access to the king of Israel, the king of Judah, which one wouldn't assume to be normal, going back to Isaiah 7, verse 3, some have theorized that he might have actually been from a high-ranking family in Jewish society. The author Isaiah had at least two sons because their names are symbolic and they're used as part of the prophecies in the book. The first, Shir Jashub, a remnant shall come, shall return, was a prophecy of the return of a few Jews after they were removed from the land as chastisement for failing to obey God. And then this next name, which is really a mouthful, Maher Shalahashbaz, hasting to the spoil, hurrying to the prey. You can only imagine if this kid got in trouble a lot. I think he'd probably get his name shortened a little bit. Anyway, Maher Shalahashbaz, his name prophesies the sack of Damascus and Samaria by the king of Assyria, who then would turn his attention to Judah later on in the book. Isaiah was contemporary with some other writing prophets, including Hosea and Micah. We will come back to them at a later time, although I may not be the one teaching them. And his brilliant writing style really indicates that he had a good education. So this is another argument in favor of the theory that he was from a high-ranking family, because he used 2,186 different vocab words in his one book. That's pretty remarkable, because most people survive on a couple of thousand words just in their day-to-day conversations, but this is just in his book. And really, if you compare that to the other major prophets, Isaiah has 500 more unique words than either Jeremiah or Ezekiel. Still more impressive, it has over 100 more unique words than the entire book of Psalms, which has 150 chapters in it. So he really pulls together and writes in a very really good and clear style that indicates a higher education maybe than some of the other prophets. He also was the author of a biography of Hezekiah. 2 Chronicles 32:32 references the fact that he wrote that account of Hezekiah's life. And Isaiah, as an author, as a prophet, is mentioned by name more than 20 times in the New Testament, lending great authority to his role as a prophet. The date of Isaiah in this book, really, is spanning roughly 50 years during the reigns of four kings in Judah. And in a minute, when we discuss the important people, we'll mention who they were. But the proposed time frame for Israel's Isaiah's life and ministry is 739 to 686 BC. Most of his life, most of his work as a prophet was spent in the setting of Judah, and specifically in the capital city of Jerusalem. His ministry was focused to Judah's kings, the ones that we're going to talk about in a few minutes, but he also made prophecies about the surrounding nations. And so the key people, these are the kings and a few others that show up in the book that are of some importance. The first, obviously, is Isaiah, the author. Well, we've gone over him a little bit already, so we'll move on to Uzziah. Uzziah was the first king under whom Isaiah was a prophet. This man lost his position as king and died of leprosy when he presumptuously offered his own sacrifice in the temple. And that really shows how far the worship of God had fallen by the time Isaiah was becoming a prophet and working his ministry. The second king, Jotham, was the son of Uzziah, and because his father was incapacitated from being king due to leprosy, he took over before Uzziah died. But then his son, Ahaz, was the king who made a treaty with Assyria. Now, that was a bad move because Assyria then came down later when Hezekiah was the king. Hezekiah was the godly king of Judah to whom Israel ministered last and also had probably one of the most detailed accounts in the book. Hezekiah was a godly king that did try to serve God with all of his heart, and he was also remembered for being the king who recovered from a very serious illness after praying to God, and as a result of his prayer, when Isaiah had already come to him and foretold that he was going to die from this illness, God sent Isaiah back before he had even left the building and told him to tell King Hezekiah that he would have several more years of life, and he gave him the miraculous sign of the sun going backwards in the sky. And later on, he did make a pretty serious mistake. This also comes into the book of Isaiah, because it was kind of a foretelling of the men from Babylon coming to take over the kingdom. When Hezekiah recovered, the king of Babylon sent a friendly envoy to congratulate him on his recovery. And Hezekiah did what a normal king would do, and he showed him all the riches and all the wealth of his kingdom. But as he did that, Isaiah came later and told him, asked him, what did you show the men from Babylon? And Hezekiah said he had held nothing back from this tour of his power and his kingdom. And Isaiah said, yes, in exchange for this indiscretion, the same country Babylon would ultimately come and take away all that as spoil to their own country after Hezekiah's life. The last name on the list, Sennacherib, was the Assyrian who attempted to take Jerusalem during Hezekiah's reign and was forced to retreat when God destroyed his army in a miraculous defeat overnight. It's really a fun section of the book to read because God is showing his power in a mighty way. As you read through the book of Isaiah, however, there are a couple of new challenges that are brought up because people who like to adopt an allegorical interpretation of the text are forced to assume that the promises intended for Israel in this book and the other prophets are also applied and really only applied now to the church. And the one system of theology that really argues this is covenant theology, which says that the church is the new Israel. But the answer to this challenge that really starts here in Isaiah is that Israel has not been replaced by the church. Isaiah clearly prophesies the restoration of Israel as a nation with the Messiah as her king. And if you'd like, I have a couple verses up here, but let's go ahead and turn to Isaiah chapter 2 and verses 2 through 4. If you don't have a Bible, you can follow along on the screen. Isaiah chapter 2 and verses 2 through 4. And it shall come to pass that in the last days the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established as the chief of the mountains, and will be raised above the hills, and all the nations will stream to it. And many peoples will come and say, Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us concerning his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For the law will go forth from Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem, and he will judge between the nations, and will render decisions for many peoples. And they will hammer their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not lift up sword against nation, and never again will they learn war. Now, if you adopt an allegorical interpretation of this that says the kingdom at the end will be the church, then why have we not ceased to have war? And why is the king seated in Israel not dispensing law and order? Why is our world government not centered out of Jerusalem and Zion? And really, we're only two chapters into the book of Isaiah here, but you've already got an instance where it doesn't make sense to try to force an application that the church is the same as Israel. Passages like this really make sense only if Israel will eventually have a future kingdom. So Israel has not been replaced like the church. And prophecies like the one we just read are meaningless if you replace the physical nation of Israel with the spiritual body of the church. Another challenge that is encountered in the book of Isaiah is this big mouthful of a term, prophetic foreshortening. And I don't know, those of you who have been here with me as I've been teaching from the beginning, probably don't remember seeing many pictures in my slides, and there's a good reason for that. But tonight, I have a good reason for including this one. This is a picture of the Peruvian mountains taken from the camp in Trujillo, where we were just at. But I didn't just put it in for the good scenery. I put it in because it serves a purpose. Look at this picture. You can see several different mountain peaks in this picture. You can tell they're different mountain peaks, but when you look at the picture, it looks like it's flat, doesn't it? It looks like they're all just kind of right there. So if you were to describe the scene, you would say a row of mountains. But yet when you drive closer to those mountains, you get to the first one, and then you can look beyond at the ones that you see over there on the left and on the right, and you realize, oh, there's actually a whole nether valley before we get to those mountains. And then if you were to keep on going, you'd find the same thing was true. Now pretend that this place where I was standing when I took this picture is the perspective that Isaiah had on the Messiah's future coming. God revealed a lot of information to Isaiah about the coming Messiah. But he revealed it, and Isaiah was looking into the future, not really able to tell very clearly the differences sometimes between the first and second comings. And as he looked long into the future, where he saw, as it were, a couple of different mountain peaks, they just kind of blurred together in a row. So many times what you see in the book of Isaiah is the blurring between these two comings, where they're described sometimes in the same prophecy, sometimes in separate prophecies, sometimes with even a double fulfillment in both comings. But as the Messiah has come, now standing on the first peak, if you will, looking at the second, we realize that there's another gap of time between the first and second comings, what we call the church age. So Isaiah might not have understood that there was going to be a long gap of time, and certainly by the time we get to the New Testament, when Jesus is talking to the disciples, they expected him to come and set up the kingdom. They weren't looking for another really long time period before Israel finally got its rulership back in the world. They were expecting that the Messiah would come and remove Rome. They wanted a Messiah who could give them the victory again. That's why so many people were disillusioned when he didn't. They misunderstood, because of this term prophetic foreshortening, the differences in the times between the first and the second comings. Now, when we look back at the prophecies of Isaiah, he's standing back on the other side of the first mountain, and we're looking ahead to the Messiah's second coming, behind at his first coming, we can really see the differences, and we can look forward to the second coming, even though we don't know how far away it is, although we do know it's getting closer. So this term prophetic foreshortening is caused when a prophet did not specify the length of time between two events, or when he described both events in the same prophecy. And Isaiah did not clarify the time between the Messiah's first and second comings. We know, because we are currently living in the gap between these two comings, that they are in fact distinct events, even though Isaiah may have only described them as the Messiah's coming. We also know this because the New Testament authors revealed more information through progressive revelation. As we look at the book of Matthew and Mark and Luke and John, and then finally we get to the book of Revelation, we get to see more of what God is planning for the future, even for us, than Isaiah would have seen. But yet we realize that it's distinct, because we're not looking forward to the Messiah's first coming anymore. We're looking ahead at his second coming. We also are more clearly able to see the distinction between the millennial reign of Christ and to realize the need for the millennial reign, the millennial kingdom, and the eternal kingdom in the new heaven and the new earth. These would be things that are similarly foreshortened for us today. Moving on then to the key doctrines in the book of Isaiah. The coming of the Messiah as a sacrifice for sins. Let's go ahead and turn to Isaiah chapter 53, please. We said that the focus of the Messiah is truly one of the main points in the whole book. This chapter, chapter 53, is termed the Suffering Servant Prophecy, and it is one of the most remarkable prophecies in this entire book. Its detail about the death of Christ is astounding, considering it was written 700 years, 700 or more years, before Jesus was even born. So we're looking at Isaiah 53. I haven't written down all the different ways in which the prophecy was fulfilled in the person of Jesus, but we'll just discuss a few. Look at verse 5. The Messiah will be a bloody sacrifice to heal us. He was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and with his stripes we are healed. That refers to the healing and the saving power of Jesus Christ's work on the cross. He bore our iniquity. Moving on to verse 6. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord hath laid on him the iniquity of us all. So the Messiah's work was intended all along to be the payment for sins caused and needed since Adam and Eve first sinned in the garden. The Messiah also bore all this punishment without complaining. In verse 7, he was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He is brought as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shearers is dumb, so he openeth not his mouth. The Messiah was foretold that as he suffered these things, he would not open his mouth. And as we look at the accounts in the New Testament, we discover that he indeed did not fight back verbally. Verse 9, he would be buried in a rich man's grave, and he made his grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death, because he had done no violence, neither was any deceit in his mouth. He was buried in Joseph of Arimathea's tomb. It was a borrowed grave. Verse 9, he was also the perfect sacrifice. That was there in the second half of the verse, because he had done no violence, neither was any deceit in his mouth. The necessity of perfection to take away the sins of an imperfect world demanded a perfect sacrifice. And only one person, one lamb, could achieve that goal. That is the Messiah. Then in verse 12, the Messiah will receive a rich reward because of his sacrifice. Therefore will I divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he hath poured out his soul unto death, and he was numbered with the transgressors, and he bare the sin of many, and made intercession for the transgressors. The Messiah is now going to become, in the future, he will sit on the earth and reign as the descendant of David over the entire world. He will have the most exalted position in the universe as God and as King. Another key doctrine is the coming of the Messiah as the King. The unending government will be vested in the prophesied child. So I've got a few things here that I've written out. I will go ahead and read these. You can follow along if you want, but you don't need to. Isaiah 9, 6 through 7. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there shall be no end, upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom, to order it and to establish it with judgment and with justice from henceforth, even forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. So this government that will be unending will be placed on the shoulders of the prophesied child, the Messiah. The earth and the animal kingdoms during the Messiah's reign will be at peace. Chapter 11, verses 6 through 9. The wolf also shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the kid, and the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. And the cow and the bear shall feed, their young ones shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. That certainly is a picture that's not typical today, is it? You've got some of the most ferocious creatures all just sitting around together having a party. But that's something that only the peace of the Messiah's reign will allow to happen. There's a couple more verses that I'm not going to go ahead and read right now for sake of time. But verse 10, his peaceful kingdom will even include the Gentiles. And in that day there shall be a root of Jesse, which shall stand for an ensign of the people. To it shall the Gentiles seek, and his rest shall be glorious." So the Jews thought they were going to have a Messiah that was their king. But Isaiah is prophesying a Messiah that all the nations of the world, including the Jews and the Gentiles, will seek to worship him. And the inhabitants of his kingdom will live long lives. Isaiah 65, verse 20. "There shall be no more thence an infant of days, nor an old man that hath not filled his days. For the child shall die 100 years old, but the sinner being 100 years old shall be accursed." So to call someone who dies at 100 years old a child, that indicates a restoration to long life. And also that no more will babies die at a young age. So when the Messiah comes as king, the world will be restored somewhat to its former state of peace, where animals and people dwell together in peace. Life is long. Life is good. Life is peaceful. All people seek to worship the King, the Messiah, because he is their King. And this is the Messiah that Isaiah prophesied. He would come as sacrifice, and he would come as king. Isaiah then is full of prophecies about the Messiah. You don't have to look far in this book to find a reference to Christ. As we've talked about tonight, he will come as the sacrifice for sins, and he will come again as the king of the world and rule on the throne of David. Let's go ahead and give a quick overview of the book. Just kind of discuss a little bit from the structure side. It begins with approximately half the book being dedicated to prophecies of punishment. These begin by prophesying destruction on the southern kingdom, and then it follows later to condemnation of foreign nations. These would be the nations that I referenced earlier that he spoke against. They were Babylon and Assyria, Philistia, Moab, Syria and Israel, Ethiopia, Egypt, Edom, Arabia, Jerusalem, Tyre. I guess Jerusalem and Israel aren't really foreign nations, but they're all included kind of in this structure of prophecies that are geared toward other areas. Before we go any further, let me just say that this was taken from the textbook. If you're reading that, then this is just kind of a condensed version of what is in the textbook, so you might recognize this. The next section, the next large section, is Isaiah's interactions with Hezekiah. And it gets about 3 chapters of the book, and it focuses on the destruction of the Assyrians when they tried to take Jerusalem, also Hezekiah's severe illness and miraculous recovery, which we discussed already. And then finally, the Babylonian emissaries who visited Hezekiah after his recovery, and the foretelling then from Isaiah that the Babylonians would eventually be the ones to come and take away all of Israel's treasures back to their land. It ends with the last large section, the prophecies of peace. That last prophecy of the coming Messiah's kingdom, where the people will live long lives, comes from this section. Isaiah comforts Israel with the promise of a glorious future. There are so many more promises than what we just read. It is going to be a glorious future that we can't imagine now because it's so far from our comprehension. The servant of the Lord featured as prophecies of the Messiah, but he's also going to be the sacrifice, and he will be the king. Both of those are in this section. And then the repetition of the theme of God's blessing during the messianic reign on earth and in heaven. So the book of Isaiah has a lot to say about the Messiah, and it comes out all throughout the book. the background of the book of Isaiah, with this we will move into the application for tonight, is that Isaiah was sent as a prophet to a people that had forgotten how to worship God with their hearts. Forgotten how to worship God with their hearts. And I'd ask you to turn in your Bibles one more time in Isaiah to Isaiah 29 and verse 13. Isaiah 29, verse 13. Wherefore the Lord said, "For as much as this people draw near me with their mouth, and with their lips do honor me, but have removed their heart far from me, and their fear toward me is taught by the precept of men." Now, I could have put like the little dot, dot, dot there. But what this is describing is a people that says a lot. They say they are followers of Jehovah. With their lips, they honor God. But at the same time, they're allowing their lips to give service to God. Their hearts are going in a completely different direction. This is the people that Isaiah was sent to minister to. The fear of God that they had was taught simply because it was a tradition, the precepts of the law that were just taught from rote scripts, as it were. They gave lip service to God and left their hearts out of it. A recurring description of Israel during Isaiah's ministry is that they were only following the forms of worshiping God. Now, not only was this a description of the people in Isaiah's day, but it was also a primary reason why the destruction of Judah was not far away. When you forget the reasons why you worship God in your heart, you lose the power of your faith in God. And that leads me to ask a question. Have you ever found yourself following the forms of Christianity without remembering its power? One more time, 2 Timothy 3, 1 through 5. According to 2 Timothy 3, 1 through 5, this is a characteristic of the last times. Second Timothy 3, 1 through 5. "This know also, that in the last days perilous times shall come, for men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, without natural affection, truce breakers, false accusers, incontinent, fierce, despisers of those that are good, traitors, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God, having a form of godliness, but denying the power thereof. From such turn away." You know, it's almost described in such a way that the people who are doing these vile and wicked things do so while they attribute lip service to God, a form of godliness. These people have a form of godliness, but they completely deny its power. And God's work is powerful enough to change your life. But when you forget why you worship God from your heart and you only give Him lip service, then this becomes a problem because the power of the gospel is not working in your heart. The power of the gospel is enough to change your life, enough to make you more like Him. Romans 1:16 says, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first and also to the Greek." The power of God is salvation. When God mercifully saves you from all that you deserve as a sinner who has turned away from Him and gone your own way, He expects your life in return. And it's only reasonable that we should give it to Him. Romans 12, 1 and 2. "Present your bodies a living sacrifice to God." When someone does something special for you, wouldn't you think, at least, you know, completely apart from God doing something big for you, it's natural that you want to do something back for the person. God has done so much more than any other human could ever do for you. Why are we so slow to give Him back anything? He gave the best gift that He could give us. Can we give him back the best gift that he wants? And that's all of us. And that's what he deserves, is all of us. And so our final application tonight, instead of being like the children of Israel, who after hundreds of years of attributing service to God, finally decided that they wanted to let their hearts run away in the opposite direction, and by doing so, ultimately earned God's judgment, chastisement, that sent them into the land of Babylon. Instead of being like that, let's keep God at the center of our lives so our Christianity doesn't become merely a form of godliness that denies the power of the gospel. Thank you very much for coming tonight. At this point, let's go ahead and divide up for prayer.